activity is in the neuroscience and the Earth Institute, and I invited her to come and talk about a really big problem, global warming. We don't talk about any small issues.
That's right. Gotta go big or go home, man.
I don't have anything to talk about Ebola. Hopefully it will be over before we decide to have a talk on it. Dr. Shaw got her bachelor's degree at the University of British Columbia. She's originally from Toronto, she tells me, but like many people, she likes to ski, and so she went to BC. And then she went back to Toronto to get her PhD, and we're fortunate she's here to work on climate change here in Vermont. But let me say that she's I've had a chance to look over to the, and she's both a descriptive biologist, but she's also a descriptive physicist who uses really quantitative terms to understand what happens in global weather, and that her mathematical confidence from looking over a few of her papers is really very impressive. So I say that because so many times we think of descriptive areas of what's going on in the world as being a sufficient explanation. But here, real quantitative data can be used, and it's important to emphasize to your students how important the math is in trying to make sense of what's going on. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for the introduction. It's a real great pleasure to be here today, and I'm going to take you through my talk, but before I do that, I want to do some advertising. I come from the Mount Doherty Earth Observatory. I'm an assistant professor there. I've been there for about 3 years, and my research focus is atmospheric and climate change, climate physics, so basically past, present, and future. And at Lamont, we study all aspects of the Earth system through theoretical aspects to applications. And normally once a year, although we didn't do it last year, we have an open house where we welcome everyone from the community to come and learn about Earth science and how exciting it is for all ages. And so some of the things you'll see today, you can learn more about if you're interested by coming. It's on October 11th, and Lamont actually is in the Palisades, which is across the Hudson River, so there will be transportation provided. If you want more information, you can visit the home site of Lamont, which is affiliated with Columbia. So in putting together this talk, I really wanted to start by something that I hope will motivate us to think together about how to better understand and explain climate change to the public. Because one of the things that really shocked me was a recent report by the Yale Project on Climate Change Knowledge. So this came out in 2010, and it was a quantitative assessment, basically, you know, quizzes and questionnaires for the public to assess their equivalency, understanding of issues related to climate change. And so I want to summarize three key points that I took away from this document. The first one, which is perhaps the most shocking, is that 8% of Americans, this was a U.S. study, understand climate change at the level equivalent of a grade of A or B. Okay, and so as an educator, I educate undergraduate students, this says that, you know, I feel like I'm failing, I need to do better. So I think we can all, you know, as educators, hopefully take that to heart. 75% of Americans, however, think that climate change should be incorporated into curricula. Okay, so the difference between these numbers suggests that there is an interest in this problem, a recognition that it's important, and that learning about it should be a part of you know, Earth science curriculum more generally. And something I'll touch upon also today is this notion of computational models, computer models, and how we understand climate. And many Americans don't feel that they're actually very useful. And hopefully I'll provide you with some examples today to convince you otherwise that these are very valuable tools. They have limitations, but they tell us something very fundamental. primarily because our science, climate, global climate, cannot be done in the laboratory, okay, if we're talking about the whole Earth. So we rely on these models to probe and better understand the system. And so hopefully you'll get a sense of that. So one of the things I like to do in my spare time, which is not that much, is to go to XKCD, and it's my favorite comic, and he also often has comics about climate change. And this one really stood out in terms of this public perception of climate change for me. It's two friends, you know, walking this winter during the polar vortex, and one of them saying, you know, it's so brutal out, so much for global warming, right? And, you know, I had this encounter many times this winter on really snowy days. And yet, you know, if you really break it down and not just think about an individual event, but think about the overall trend, the fact that changes can happen over longer timescales superimposed on large fluctuations, the friend points out to his friend that you're from St. Louis, right? And if you look at the data here shown as dots, the number of days where the temperature has gone below 0 degrees Fahrenheit has decreased significantly just since the 1970s. And there's a citation here, if these aren't, you know, also obviously a comic, but and so in 2014, you know, when we dipped down below 0 degrees for 2 days, according to the comic, you know, everybody starts to panic and extrapolate this onto the global climate. Interestingly, while there was very cold air in Chicago, there was very warm air in Alaska, so one has to be cognizant of a global problem. And so, you know, nevertheless, after this conversation, the friend sees a patch of ice and once again says, so much for global warming. So let's think about that, and really this motivates a lot of my research in terms of education to have people, you know, better understand the context of the problem and what tools we use as scientists to understand what's going on. Because we're in for some very big changes. So I'll draw once more upon XKCD, and then I'll stop and get into some real material here. But, you know, without prompt aggressive limits on CO2 emissions, the Earth is going to warm by approximately 4 to 5 degrees Celsius. And I'll walk you through that limit today. And so how big of a change is that? Let's put this into global climate, you know, the big problem, the globally average surface temperature. So we have a graph here, and each unit, either to the left or to the right, represents a value of the globally average surface temperature. So the coldest part of the last ice age was 4.5 degrees below zero Celsius. So that puts us here, what is defined as minus one ice age unit, which is equal to minus 4.5. And if we were to be then, back then, where we are now, we would be under about a half a mile of ice. Okay, so that's a big difference compared to today, where we will normalize it to be about zero. What we're in for in the future here is about, on this scale, plus one ice age unit. And the big question that drives a lot of the research that I'm involved in is this big question mark. Where are we going to be in 86 years? What will our neighborhoods look like? Okay. And so with that in mind, I want to tell you today just about some aspects that I'm going to broadly define here as the physics of climate change. So that, you know, really trying to hit home here that we don't just understand this by, you know, using geography or you know, qualitative kind of problems. We actually use quantitative methods to break down and understand what we see. And so the first question one might ask, especially I get this when I, you know, visit family or friends, is, you know, what do you do, and, you know, basically how do you understand weather and climate, which is, you know, I tell them that's what I do. And it comes down to sort of the following points, which is we can understand both its weather and climate, which are distinguished by different timescales. Weather occurs on faster timescales than climate does, using physics, okay? And this is a broad description, but I want to talk today about how we can break it down using conservation of energy and conservation of momentum, and even, very importantly, thermodynamics. And, you know, how can we make predictions? This is a fundamental question in science. How can we predict a system with fidelity? In this case, we can make predictions of both weather and climate because they satisfy the laws of physics, okay? I ask my undergraduates every year at the beginning of class, where do weather forecasts come from? And you won't believe the answers I get. Weather forecasts, just like climate model forecasts, come from computer simulations of mathematical equations which represent physical laws, okay? The culmination of what we believe is the understanding, the physical basis of the system. And since the system must obey those laws, quote unquote, then we can actually make a prediction of how it will respond to changes in carbon dioxide, for example. So I want to just take you through, before getting into some research results, a few of what I think are perhaps useful examples of this energy and momentum concepts as they apply to climate. But I want to start with energy, because really when we take a step back and consider our position in the universe, it really comes down into why Earth is habitable. It comes down to energy and radiation and, you know, solar radiation from the sun. So there's many forms of energy that are important for the climate system: thermal, kinetic, potential, and electromagnetic. And when we ask if a planet is habitable, the first thing we might want to know is its temperature, averaged over the entire surface. And I'll show you that can be easily deduced from principles of energy balance of electromagnetic wave radiation. So the concept that, you know, we're sitting on this giant sea rock from the moon, and we receive shortwave radiation from the sun. Shortwave radiation comes in two forms for our purposes of our definition: visible and ultraviolet. Okay, mostly visible, which is often misunderstood. Many undergraduates feel that UV is the most important component. We can see because the sun, you know, is providing us with visible radiation. And how it kind of interacts and the interplay of that type of radiation with what we call infrared, or long wave, because it has a longer wavelength than the shortwave radiation from the sun. And these components come from the Earth and the atmosphere, and the reason why there's this separation of wavelength is because from physics we know that each body radiates at a wavelength proportional to its temperature. So the sun is very hot, it's about 6,000 degrees Kelvin, okay, at its surface, and that leads to a shorter wavelength emission of radiation than the Earth, which is on the average, globally averaged, maybe 300 Kelvin, or 15 degrees Celsius. So what we need to do then, if we consider a long time average where, you know, energy has to be balanced, it cannot be created or destroyed, is to consider what kind of energy comes in, what kind of energy comes out. They have to be equal if the system isn't heating up or cooling down, and we can determine the temperature. And so that's one of the first lessons that I teach in my undergraduate class. This is actually a slide from that class. And it looks complicated, but it's not. And so hopefully I'll convince you of that by walking you through the details here. So what we have is a schematic where the ground is on the bottom. We've got in between space, which is up here at the top, what I've labeled an infrared absorbing layer. Okay? And now what I want to do is just trace through how this electromagnetic wave radiation will interact as it transmits downward and upward through this three layers of our notional atmosphere problem in space. So here is the solar radiation. Don't mind the coefficients, it doesn't matter. It's in yellow. It comes downward from the surface. It's partly reflected by clouds. It can also be reflected by ice at the surface. This is the albedo, which is alpha. So some of it comes in, but some of it gets reflected out. And some of it reaches the surface, where it's absorbed, and we have this conversion of electromagnetic wave radiation type of energy into thermal energy, that's temperature, internal energy. So the Earth starts to absorb this radiation, and then it starts to emit. Like any good material, it emits, according to physics, proportional to the fourth power of its temperature. So here it's Tg to the 4. This has a name, it's the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Now, because this infrared, this layer is infrared absorbing, it's not going to allow that radiation to go through. It's actually going to take a big chunk out of it. And what will remain at the top will be 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon, we'll say, is the absorption coefficient. Okay? So that's the transmission of the terrestrial radiation, but once this radiation is absorbed by the atmosphere, it will itself warm up, okay, proportional to its temperature, and it emits this layer both upward and downward with the coefficient, an emission coefficient equal to its absorption coefficient, epsilon, but at a temperature proportional to the atmospheric layer itself. So there's a lot of arrows here, but the good thing is all we have to do is just determine the sign of the arrows, and at each level, assess what goes in and assume it has to equal what goes out. So let's start at the bottom, the ground. What's going into the ground is the net amount of solar radiation subtracting off what's been reflected. So I put that over here. Here's the same mathematical expression, algebraic expression. What's also going into the ground is the emission from the atmosphere. And what's a remarkable fact is that the surface actually receives more in terms of watts per meter squared, energy flux, energy from the atmosphere than it does from the sun. Okay, and so we'll see how that can be deduced from these algebraic equations. And then it loses energy according to epsilon. This is just a constant times temperature of the ground to the fourth power. So this is what goes in on the left. That's what goes out. So I can do that now for each layer. The atmospheric layer here absorbs something's going into it from the ground, TG. But then in both directions, we have emission outward. So that's simple enough. At the top of the atmosphere, we have again what's going down, so we subtract off of the solar radiation here. What's going out to space is the remnants of the terrestrial radiation, the part that wasn't absorbed by the atmosphere. And what's going out also is this emission from the atmosphere. Okay, so now it comes down to actually use these equations to figure out the temperature of the ground, which is our ultimate goal. You know, if we wanted on any given planet to know what the surface temperature is, we could do this exact same thing. It doesn't have to be Earth. And what we can deduce is two very interesting facts. Because, in fact, for those who are mathematically inclined, we have three equations and two unknowns. The two unknowns here are temperature of the atmosphere, temperature of the ground. We know S, that's the solar radiation from the sun. So we need to solve these two, and we have a sufficient number of equations to determine the two unknown variables. And there's two limits I have noted on the bottom here. If epsilon is zero, which just means there's no atmosphere, the temperature of the ground is very, very cold. So 0 degrees Celsius is 273 Kelvin, so this is below zero. So without the atmosphere, and more specifically, I'll show you in a minute, carbon dioxide or non-condensing greenhouse gases, we're going to have a very cold surface, which will not be allowing, you know, it's not going to be habitable if it's that cold, for example. But if we start to crank up the value of epsilon to something chosen to achieve, in this case, a reasonable temperature of about 15 degrees Celsius, things become a lot nicer on the surface of this planet, Earth, we call it. And it's clearly because of this infrared absorbing layer that's sending radiation down to the surface to help warm it up. So this is the zeroth dimensional problem for determining the surface of a planet. And this is used in astronomy all the time. So these sort of theoretical balanced equations were developed in parallel both in atmospheric science and astronomy. Now what's been neglected here, you may have noticed, is anything to do with, really, with clouds or convection or the movement of air. So the next layer we can take is make a diagram a little more complicated, add in things like convection and evaporation. But by and large, it's the same principle. At the surface, all the forms of energy, you know, have to be adding up so that there's no net loss if the system is in equilibrium. No net residual, that there would be, you know, all of them sum to zero. We're in a situation now, as I'll show you, that we're not in equilibrium, and that's because of increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. And that means to become in equilibrium, some of these components have to change, and in particular, the surface of the planet has to warm up. Here I've just shown you that the kind of energetics become a little bit more complicated. If we want to take the atmosphere as a column, we have radiation at the top, minus radiation at the bottom, any kind of heat flux, and then we can also consider heat release due to precipitation. But the principle remains the same. Okay, it can get very complicated, as we'll see, especially if we increase the dimensionality. We were just dealing here with the vertical dimension, up and down. It's often described, and one thing I forgot to mention, is that this epsilon, it strongly depends on carbon dioxide, but it also strongly depends on water vapor, okay? Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. It strongly absorbs in the infrared part of the spectrum at a different wavelength than carbon dioxide. But can anyone tell me what's the big difference between these two gases? Does anyone come to mind? What's special about water vapor? What's special about water on Earth?
We exist at all three states.
We have three states that we observe it at: ice, liquid, and vapor. Okay? And carbon dioxide is, for the Earth's temperature and pressure, it's in vapor form. Okay, so this is a condensable greenhouse gas, meaning it can condense into liquid, and this is a non-condensable greenhouse gas. And they're both very important, but if you're talking about long times, evolution of climate, this one is quite finicky. It's condensing and evaporating and condensing and going back and forth. This one, we now know, is the principal control knob for epsilon on long time scales. So it's going to determine the temperature. And we can see this in the geological record, but you can also do something very simple with a model. This is a model that we just looked at, but done in a more computationally realistic way with convection. So I'm taking some results here from colleagues of mine at NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is above Tom's Restaurant, for those who are in the know who watch Seinfeld. And what they did was they took a simple model. This, again, globally average, is actually not simple in this case, it's horizontally varying. But they performed the following experiment, which they zeroed out the non-condensing greenhouse gases. So they took away carbon dioxide, and also methane, and other smaller contributions to that epsilon value. And this is a very simple calculation, but it's a very powerful result. I mean, it was published in Science, which is a very good measure of high impact. And what they find, if you just focus on the black curve, after turning off or removing, zeroing out the non-condensing greenhouse gases, the temperature drops considerably from a reasonable 15 degrees, which we would consider habitable on the globally average surface temperature, to something on the order of minus 20 degrees surface temperature. Okay, and it doesn't actually freeze over. It's not a snowball Earth, but this is certainly very cold. Okay, and the point of illustration here is to show that it's not water vapor that's going to be the principal control knob on surface temperature over long time scales, and that it's more or less responding and recycling with things like cloud cover and column water vapor, but it really is CO2 that's going to keep the Earth habitable, and so therefore we should be monitoring CO2. And we'll get into how CO2 has been changing in a minute. But let's just turn briefly to the other ingredient, which I think is very important for understanding climate, which is just momentum. And this is one of my big interests, because as soon as you step away from the vertical column, which is largely what we've been talking about, you have to deal with the fact that air moves around. I mean, it's actually a remarkable thing to look at a weather map. For example, we've had two recent hurricanes passing by Hawaii. For those of you who are here in the city for Hurricane Sandy, it's pretty amazing that just putting air on a quasi-spherical planet, we can get this wide range of phenomena, winter storms, and so on and so forth, the trade winds, a lot of interesting features. So how do we understand that? It turns out that air, both its energy and momentum, is governed by laws of physics. And what we know, generally speaking, about why does any body move, comes from the second law, Newton's second law, which is essentially a conservation of momentum principle. So if a body is going to accelerate, it has to have a force applied to it. And of course, there's some relationship also to its mass. In the atmosphere, we think an awful lot about the winds at the surface, and so that's some manifestation, but it's called the surface wind stress in this case. And the relevant forces is what we need to consider. How to frame this problem requires some thought about what forces can affect air in the Earth's atmosphere. One can also do this for the ocean. But let's focus on the atmosphere. One of the really important ones is pressure differences between the equator and the pole. So the Earth is not a sphere, but it's quasi-spherical, and due to that nature, due to its quasi-spherical nature, it receives differential amount of sunlight. At the equator, you get maximum sunlight, and at the pole, you get minimum sunlight, if you average over, let's say, the year. When we have maximum amount of sunlight at the equator, this is going to create very warm conditions, as we know. This is going to create lower pressure, just because molecules that have higher temperature like to spread out, okay? But the opposite will be true at the pole. We're going to have a cold pole, which is associated with a denser atmosphere, so higher pressure. And the tendency, in terms of a force, is to push air from high to low, okay? Because the molecules are going to exert that difference, and that's one of the primary influences for redistributing the energy that's building up at the equator because of the sun and the fact that we have a deficit at the pole. So if we can move that energy around through the wind, that's going to make the Earth a lot more habitable. We have a few other forces which are really important. One of them is the so-called Coriolis force, and this comes about because we are in a rotating planet. And we call it a fictitious force because it's due to the fact that the planet is rotating and we're not in a so-called inertial reference frame. And so we don't have to contend with it if we were not standing on the Earth, but by virtue of being on Earth and observing the satellites that are co-rotating with Earth, we have this additional force. And we'll see how it comes into play. And then friction, obviously, near the surface. So given this difference between the equator and the pole, I wanted to show you the kind of very interesting patterns that emerge. I've taken some data here where I've averaged in the longitudinal direction, and what I'm showing you is various components of the wind, but let's just start with the axes here. We have latitude and pressure. For atmospheric scientists, pressure is our vertical coordinate because pressure decreases uniformly with height, so this is just upward. And the black contours here show mass transport, mass movement, both vertically here near about 5 degrees north in the so-called intertropical convergence zone. Air rises up where it's warmest. And then in the upper regions by the tropopause, it diverges toward the poles. And then we find it sinking here in the subtropics, where we have the world's deserts. Okay, so subsiding air pushing down is not a very favorable situation at all for convection, so these regions are very dry. And then as we move toward the poles, in regions where we are, the so-called extratropics, we have the ferrocell, which actually rotates, in this case, in the opposite direction. So that sort of covers the up-down, north-south part of the problem. And then in colors, I'm showing you the east-west wind. And so what you can see are these two bullseyes at each, or at the edges of this Hadley cell, where the flow begins to descend. And these are jet streams, okay? Very strong currents of air, and around 40 meters per second. This is where you've probably even been there if you've flown in a commercial airline, okay? And so what I would like to just explain for you now is how can we conceptualize the presence of this jet stream? Why is it there? What's the simple explanation from physics? It turns out we just have to consider how an air parcel, just like from Newton's laws, if we consider a free body diagram, what are the forces being exerted on air in the upper atmosphere as it's moving toward the poles? Okay, so remember, the top part of this Hadley cell, we're moving, in this case, we'll just depict the flow going toward the North Pole. So as it tends to try to flow north, that's the force being exerted on it. The Coriolis force, which is shown here in green, begins to deflect it to the right. And as a result of that deflection, when the forces become in equilibrium, we get a strong eastward current of air, which is flowing around the axis here in longitude, which represents our jet stream. And so the Coriolis force depends strongly on latitude, and this is because of conservation of so-called angular momentum. And the best analogy to consider is when you are an ice skater, and if you can actually do these types of spins, or if you've ever seen an ice skater do a spin, as she brings her arms closer to her body, she spins up. She spins faster, okay? And the reason for that is because she's decreasing the distance between her arms and the axis of rotation, which is her body. That's what, the direction she's rotating about. And in a similar way here, as the air moves closer and closer to its axis of rotation, which is the pole, it begins to spin up, in this case, an eastward moving jet stream. And we get the same principle occurring as we move toward the southern pole. So that's without any mathematics. And another thing I want to show you today, just to solidify some of this movement of air, which, truth be told, this is where the beauty of combining physics and math comes into play in this problem. You know, the atmosphere is turbulent. Turbulence represents one of the, in terms of the classical mechanical problem, one of the most important unsolved problems in physics, okay, aside from like particle physics problems. And it's really complicated to kind of distill because there's a lot of mathematics, but one of the great things that's happened in our field in the recent past, as any good physicist should be able to do, some colleagues of mine at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have found a way to distill and demonstrate the essential ingredients of the movement of air in a very simple platform. If we think we understand the problem, we should be able to do this. And so here's the setup, something that John and I worked on last week. It's called the weather in a tank, and it allows us to combine the two things that are most important for demonstrating things like the Hadley cell, for the weather systems that we saw, that we'll see. And the first principle is rotation, so the fact that we're on a rotating planet. So what we're going to do here is mimic that with, you can see this platform, it's actually attached to a motor that will allow it to rotate. And we'll control the rotation, right? And then on top of it, we have a cylinder here. Well, actually, it's a rectangle, but we can insert a circular insert, and it's filled with water, okay? And what we'll do is we'll artificially create, or purposefully create, a temperature difference between a cold inner aluminum container filled with ice water and the rest of the water, which is room temperature. And that's going to be sufficient for creating something that mimics the warm equator and the cold pole. So I'm going to show you some videos. These are not the videos that John and I made last week, but these are a lot more professional. So I think I'll go with these. So here's the setup. This is looking at a plane of view, bird's eye view down. So there's a camera, just like on a satellite. It's going to be co-rotating with the platform, so you won't see any manifestation of that rotation. What's in the center here is the ice water. And what's external to that is the room temperature water. Okay, so that's our temperature gradient, moving radially outward. And because this is water, of course, in order to visualize it, we have to add some kind of dye. So at the bottom here, you're looking at potassium permanganate, which is effective at sinking to the bottom, and then it will start to move as the water moves around. And this will, you'll see, trace out some very nice patterns. And then in a minute in this video, you'll see a hand coming in. It will zoom out. And the hand is just distributing some dots to help trace out the pattern of the water, the movement of the water. And so this is a case with very slow rotation. It's basically as slow as we can go without the turntable being off, okay? So dye has been added here. This is just green food coloring. And it's not going to sink because it's not heavy like the purple dye. It's going to trace out the flow pattern. And a few minutes later, what we see is this beautiful quasi-laminar pattern that's moving faster and faster as you get toward this ice water bath. And this is our jet stream, okay, in the phenomenology I just introduced to you. So in particular, what's going on is when we have the very cold water, ice water bath, which is going to cool down the water right next to the container, it's going to want to spread out and move away from that container and displace the relatively warm room temperature water that's out here at the edge. And that can be seen by tracing out, following this purple dye. And then it rises up along the sides of the container because it's fundamentally bounded by this annular configuration. It rises up just like air rises up in the intertropical convergence zone. And then it begins to move at the top here, at the surface of the water, toward the pole, which is this ice water bath. And it's that same movement toward the pole as the ice skater brings her arms toward her body that spins up this very fast current of water that is notionally a representation in the simple experiment of the jet stream. Now we can do the same thing, but just increase the rotation rate. Anybody have a guess, want to hazard a guess what will happen? Let's say we increase it by a factor of 10. So it was 1 revolution per minute, now it's 10 revolutions per minute. There's no wrong answer here. I'm not expecting you to know. It will it be different or the same?
It will also get
a
pattern with the
length
of the ring
right there. Okay, that's not very reasonable. It's certainly going to be the case that the ring should still be there within some rotation rate. But as we'll see, when it gets too high, the ring doesn't survive. And we'll show you what happens now. One thing I want to say is, what this is meant to mimic, because it's very important to make analogies concrete, as we move the rotation rate and increase it, actually, we're thinking of moving toward the pole again, right? This is the same kind of concept. So what's being introduced here, which was not present before, is a really strong Coriolis force, which depends strongly on the latitude of where we are on Earth. So this is a better representation of where we are here in the extratropics in the previous example, which is more or less the tropical atmosphere with the Hadley circulation and the jet stream. So let's do this. It's the exact same setup, you know. And instead of doing that green, that purple dye, we'll just put the green dye here around the cold ice water bath, near the ice water bath. And we're going to add red dye to trace out how the water that's room temperature, that's closest to the boundary of the annulus, how it moves. And so we'll wait a few seconds again. And beautifully, the pattern looks very different, okay? And if we spend enough time looking at this and actually do some quantitative measurements, what we find is there's some circulations that are representing high and low pressure patterns, okay? Just like the weather systems that we see on Earth during wintertime. And there's a beautiful theory that will tell us how many we expect, how many lows and highs we expect. It's determined by the difference in temperature. But ultimately, over longer and longer times, what's going to happen is the water is just going to turn brown, okay? And that's because we're effectively moving the cold water, which is green, outward, and the warm water, which is red, inward, and we're stirring it up like using a big spoon, okay? But in this case, it's not with the spoon. It's actually with the internal movement of air that's generated by the presence of rotation and temperature gradients. If we were to even increase it faster, it would break down and we would see something similar to Jupiter's red spot, a really coherent spot that many people have seen via satellite images. And just to come back to the spreading out of this jet stream, it turns out why this pattern is created is because that jet stream is no longer stable, quote unquote. So just like when someone smokes a cigarette, at some point it's laminar, the smoke coming off the cigarette, and then it becomes really turbulent. And what the difference between those two states is that small perturbations, as it gets perturbed by the air aloft above the person's head, actually breaks down the pattern because you cannot support the laminar flow anymore. And the same analogy is occurring here. So there's that beautiful ring we saw that was quasi-laminar. But for sufficient rotation rates, we can actually break that down. And the preferential way of breaking that down is by creating this wavy type of high-low pattern that we experience in any situation that we have strong enough temperature gradients and a high enough rotation rate. So this is a really fundamental result for rotating planets that have temperature gradients between the equator and the pole. So that's going to be the sort of conclusion of my sort of general description of some principles that we might find useful when thinking about climate change, because now I want to actually address the problem of climate change. So climate is always changing, okay? And what I want to talk about today, specifically with respect to that problem, is the following curve, which represents carbon dioxide concentrations varying from 1700 to this is available online. I just took this away, downloaded this yesterday or 2 days ago. So this is like real-time data, okay? We use this in our class all the time. And we're about to hit a kind of milestone. We've already exceeded 400 parts per million by volume in certain months, but soon enough we will exceed it as an annual value. These are all annual values. And so, of course, what's very striking is that for a long time, we were in here between 250 and 300 parts per million by volume, but we've seen a very strong acceleration, strong positive trend toward increasing values of carbon dioxide. And we know that this is coming from anthropogenic sources. Okay, you can do that calculation primarily from the burning of fossil fuels. So there's many other greenhouse gases like methane, but we'll just focus on, for the purposes of discussion today, the response to carbon dioxide. So when you see that curve, this is what I would hope a good, you know, a student of earth science, a student of the world maybe, would be able to, how they would be able to break down the response of the Earth's atmosphere and climate to that increase. So how did carbon dioxide come into the story I just told you? It came into the story through my description of energy in the context of the interaction and largely the absorption of long-wave radiation in the atmosphere by carbon dioxide that we called long-wave. And the way that I labeled that in my little diagram with all of the arrows was this epsilon factor. The absorption power of the atmosphere. Increasing carbon dioxide will change the atmospheric long wave absorption. I'm going to increase epsilon when I increase carbon dioxide. It's going to be, the atmosphere will be more efficient at absorbing atmosphere emitted from the ground. So that will have the consequence of having less terrestrial long wave radiation at the top of the atmosphere. So the amount from the ground, more of it is absorbed, less of it goes out to space. It also has the consequence of more long wave downward at the surface. So this is from the atmosphere itself. Remember there were those two arrows emanating from the atmosphere. Now more of it's coming down to the surface. So to achieve an energy balance, if we're emitting more energy to the surface, as that energy is absorbed, it will translate to increased temperature and more radiation from the surface at a higher temperature. So that's without doing anything sophisticated. No, sophisticated computer modeling, nothing at all. And in fact, the prediction of what would happen in response to increased fossil fuels was, that's the first way it was actually calculated, following that sort of standard model I described before with the arrows. And it was done by Arrhenius, a famous Swedish chemist, I guess, who won the Nobel Prize back in 1896. And his prediction back then was that, you know, in general terms here, if you increase the carbon dioxide concentration by about 2 times, you would get about 2 Kelvin or 2 degrees Celsius worth of globally average temperature change. So this is a very simple calculation, and basically a lot of what the field is working on is improving this calculation and not just having a number for the entire planet, but also understanding how it gets distributed geographically. So going back to that XKCD comic. And maybe this seems like a small amount, but one of the important factors to consider is, well, the direct forcing comes from carbon dioxide through this change in epsilon, primarily due to carbon dioxide. A warmer atmosphere, which we deduced from the sort of physical arguments here, can hold more moisture. This is a fundamental principle called the Clausius-Clapeyron relation. And more moisture means more greenhouse effect from water vapor. But we don't consider that a forcing. That's more like a positive feedback. So for a small amount of warming from CO2, we get more water vapor, which produces more warming. And we can actually quantify that. It can increase the temperature response even to become even larger. So now I want to just walk you through increasing the dimensionalities of what we find and using these models to kind of predict indicators of how the system will respond. So again, the standard model, which includes just radiation, shortwave, longwave, can be upgraded to include convection. We call it a radiative convective model. It still represents only one point on Earth, but now vertically varying. And you can determine the vocal structure of that response following the energetics, largely it's just energy balance from that standard model. And this was done back in 1967. And the prediction, which was consistent with Arrhenius, that right at the surface here, this is temperature versus height or pressure, we have a warming. But then interestingly, in the stratosphere, partly due to the presence of ozone and other things, we will have a cooling in response to increased carbon dioxide. So these are predictions from the model, from the physical laws that we expect the system to satisfy. And what now is of interest is to detect these responses. And indeed, we have been able to detect a cooling of the stratosphere, which is partly also responding to ozone depletion, but these things are emerging, so to speak. So we have satellite observations that tell us as much. But we certainly want to know more. We don't just want to treat the entire problem as a vertically dependent problem. We want to know how it's going to be distributed over the surface. In order to do that, you have to... things get more complicated, but also more interesting. You have to think about turbulence and momentum and the movement of air, the Hadley cell I talked about, and the jet stream. And you can no longer do that type of a calculation very simply like this one, which was done with a computer, but you could do this one on your laptop. We have to resort to something that developed largely after the Second World War, but you know, mainly in the 50s and 60s, the so-called climate models. And so it's a graded representation of the planet. So it's discrete, meaning at each point here, for example, we consider the atmosphere varying vertically, just like in our standard model. But now this column is not independent from the neighboring ones because air can blow through the columns and bring different temperatures and momentum. So it's... we've basically cut up the entire planet, extending from the surface up into the atmosphere, into these rectangles or cubes, depending on the resolution. And at each of these points, we solve the same type of mathematical equations that tell us from physics, you know, what things have to be conserved and so forth. The same type of representation is relevant for weather models. The main difference between them is that these little chunks of atmosphere that are being carved out here are bigger for a climate model, about 100 by 100 kilometers, because of current basically computational purposes, we can't actually decrease the resolution that much, and also because we have to integrate them, predict very far into the future. For a weather model, these can get down to 10, 1 kilometer on each side. Okay. The issue, of course, is that if your box is 100 by 100, then you can't necessarily, you have to kind of represent what's happening in that box in some way, and that is really important for things like convection and clouds. So they're artificially represented in these models, but nevertheless, they are subjected to the exact same sort of conservation properties that holds for the entire atmosphere as a whole. So we make these models, okay, that depend on longitude, latitude, and height now. And they're based on the laws of physics that we believe govern the movement of air, precipitation, temperature on Earth. Now, in order to have confidence that these models are at all useful, they have to be compared. And climate scientists are very good at comparing observations with data. We've had an active satellite program since the early 1980s. And so here's a comparison with the satellite observation. And this is a medium range weather forecast, so it's not exactly a climate model, but it's in between the weather and climate type of models. And you can see, actually kind of grainy on this side, but that's partly because of the resolution. But in general, a lot of the features are being captured here. And this is the model, for interest's sake, that actually was the first to predict the trajectory of Hurricane Sandy, the strange recurving into New Jersey that is not often a trajectory seen for North Atlantic tropical cyclones. So they're really getting better. Of course, we use them for very specific purposes. So just like any experiment in a laboratory, these models are really our primary tool because we cannot perform experiments on the Earth. I mean, we actually are performing one right now in terms of changing the composition, increasing carbon dioxide. But in general, that's not the case. And so these models are used to sort of test our physical understanding. We subject them to hypotheses. One of the things they can tell us is to determine the factors contributing to the recent increase of temperature that we've seen, which is about 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that's the past perspective. We can also ask what they looked like for ice age climates. And then we can ask them to make a prediction of the future, just like a weather forecast, but much longer timescales. And they're limited, the models. You know, they cannot tell you what's going to happen at your house in 2100 on August 11th, okay? They're not going to tell you that, okay? What they're good for is telling you the average conditions in time and in space, and those are sufficient for understanding things like how much precipitation will fall, for example, over North America. That's a question these models can answer now, and that's really important for agricultural applications and so on. So they have limitations, but they're very useful. And I think one important analogy to biology here is that we use these models in a similar kind of hierarchical approach that molecular biology has made use of by looking at organisms like E. coli and the fruit fly, and then understanding how those ideas can extrapolate to larger organisms. We use simplified models, like, you know, models that don't have a planets that don't have a tilt here, planets that don't have continents, planets that don't have oceans actually moving. They can just be prescribed temperature, to really build up our physical intuition and to, you know, to make tests for like hypotheses. And we can also remove influences, like we can have a dry planet, no water vapor. We can also remove dimensions from the problem. So these are all very attractive physical aspects of these models. But let me just showcase for you what the models have been telling us. So many of these results I'll be showing are from the latest assessment, the fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So this is a body of the UN whose job it is to understand or have a statement about the climate, the state of Earth's climate, and what's going to happen in the future. The fifth assessment report was just released recently in 2013. And it's a collection of scientists from all over the world, and they assess everything from the science to the applications to the impacts and so on. So here's one figure from that report. Let's focus on the center. And so what it's showing is the historical temperature from 1905 approximately to, in this case, 2005. And we have two different curves here, or three. The black is the observations, and the pink and blue are from the models. So here's what has been done with the models. If we take the models, which are these computer simulations that are governed by physics, and we only subject them to natural forcings, and by that I mean changes in the solar cycle, changes in volcanoes, that's the prediction in blue. So clearly there's a very big difference between the black line and the blue line. But then we can do a second scenario where we subject the models to both the natural forcings, so the same solar and volcanoes, but also changes in carbon dioxide due to fossil fuel burning, and also changes in aerosols, which are the tiny particulates that produce acid rain. And we can see that upon including those additional factors, we do a much better job of representing the temperature change that has occurred over the past several decades. And so this is largely why many climate scientists think that the current global warming, and which will of course be continuing, is dominantly due to anthropogenic and most importantly fossil fuel emissions. In order to get a future prediction, we have to give them the change in carbon dioxide, okay? And so what's done as a part of this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is there's certain pathways of what we call scenarios of emission, and we want to span, you know, a large range of what might happen in the future. Maybe we become very good people and we curb our carbon, this is gigatons of carbon emissions, you know, and maybe things get cleaned up and it decreases, so we can put that in the model. But what if it's the worst possible situation and we just continue to emit without any, without even thinking twice, and we end up in a very high emission scenario? And so in this blue curve, which is the high emission scenario, we achieve about four times the carbon dioxide value that we had in the pre-industrial times. And in the blue, in the green, we sort of flatten out. And so let's look at what the predictions are for those two cases. So this represents the model response, so the same as that kind of standard model. We have, in this case, 40 models for the red and 32 for the blue, 42 in the past, telling us what they think the globally average surface temperature will be like as a function of year. So this is the historical time, okay? In 42 models, this was the one that we just saw. It has a reasonable representation of the real observations. And then in the future, both of these curves, whether it's the sort of low emission scenario and the high emission scenario, produce warming, so zero is right here. But we have varying degrees of warming, ranging from, you know, a degree or so, partly because methane is also being controlled here, to a very large 4 degrees globally average. And this was what was represented in that XKCD comic. And but there's a significant amount of spread. You can see it, some models predict upward of 5.5 degrees Celsius increase. So that's something that we could do even in our simple case, that standard model. But what these completely, you know, globally representative models allow us to look at is the pattern of change. Okay. So on the left, I'm going to show you the low emission scenario. So that's the one that has the smallest surface temperature increase, globally averaged. And on the right is the high emission scenario. Let's not look at the details. Let's just take away some really important facts about global warming in response to changes in carbon dioxide. Warming is larger over land than over ocean. And warming is larger over the poles. Okay? And these two facts have been predicted for some time, since the beginning of these climate model assessments. There's good physical, energetic understanding of why this happens due to the Arctic boundary layer and also transport of heat from lower latitudes. So the temperature pattern is, of course, very worrisome because a lot of where the agriculture is occurring will get a lot warmer. But one has to also consider precipitation, which is here on the bottom. And if we focus on the highest scenario, really high emission scenario, we can see some general patterns of wetting in the extratropical latitudes, drying in the subtropical latitudes where the deserts are, and wetting again in the tropics. So what we describe this as is wet get wetter and dry get drier. And this is a pattern that also has very good physical underpinnings. I just want to highlight now some of our recent research in my group. So we've described a little bit about, you know, precipitation changes. I should say, globally average, the precipitation will increase. And that's a fundamental result of the changes in radiation that can be connected through these energy balance arguments, also because of evaporative changes due to the warming. So some of our recent results have been focused on changes in the jet stream. So jet stream is important because it's largely where these high and low pressure systems exist. They sort of ride along the jet stream as a really fast current and fast-moving air current. And consistent with previous research, we found here, if you just look at the red line, which is the peak jet stream, so if the positive represents strong eastward flow, and the black line is the response, there's this dipole about the red line, which suggests that the jet streams are going to shift toward the poles. And this is a robust feature of all of the different seasons, which are shown here, with different degrees in terms of latitudes of the shifts. So that's sort of the next step in understanding, rather than just focusing on the vertical column, now we're talking about latitude. And so, you know, as these storms shift toward the north, they bring with them the strong wind events, the strong precipitation events that we see. And so there's, of course, a reason behind why this momentum has shifted, this force has shifted, and we're actively looking into that. One of the things that we've noticed, if you focus on the near-surface winds and you make a pattern, a plot as a function of longitude and latitude, the pattern looks a lot more complicated than this simple kind of polar shift that we see when we average over longitude. And I want to draw your attention here to the Pacific Basin. The red line just shows you where the maximum jet stream is presently today, and the colors show you the difference. So here on the west coast of the Pacific Basin, you have a polar shift, so there's an increase toward the north. But on the east coast, where we have a sensitive region, for example, the southwest of North America, which is currently in a drought, we have an equatorward shift. So we've and dissecting this pattern, and one of the interesting things that we found is that if you look at, for example, the high and low, the patterns of change of the highs and lows that we have in the atmosphere, which are independent of time, so those that exist because of topography, because of changes in ocean temperature, a lot of this pattern, complicated pattern in the Pacific, is because we're going to have this very strong low pressure that's quasi-stationary in the future with a high pressure over the continent. So this is just some slice in the middle of the atmosphere. And that's through the next century. This is what the models predict for the high emission scenario. And I just want to draw your attention to the pattern that we had this past winter, which was the so-called polar vortex, and it was exactly opposite. Well, the low here is over Hudson's Bay. The prediction now is to have a high over the continent more generally, with a low rather than a high off of the East Coast. So this is good news for Southwest North America, where we'll bring wetter and cooler conditions, something that they're very much looking forward to. The next thing I just want to briefly describe is summertime, so that's shift 6 months in the seasonal cycle. And I really like thinking about summertime in contrast to winter, because it's a very different type of organization of the atmospheric flow. In wintertime, we deal a lot with storms and the jet stream. In the summertime, we deal with monsoons. So this is the strong increase of precipitation over land areas, both in Asia and in North America. And they largely follow the sun. So in the black countries here, you're seeing very low pressure over Asia, where the temperatures are very high. And that's consistent with our understanding of thermodynamics. And then in general, over the ocean basins, we have these anticyclone patterns, because the temperature over the ocean is relatively cooler than over land in summertime. So the colors, again, represent the change. What's going to happen between now and 2100? And what's really remarkable that drew our attention immediately was that there's no colors in this red oval that I've traced out. And so what is going on really requires some kind of an explanation. Why? How can it be that there's no response in the largest monsoon on Earth, that it's not responding in terms of wind patterns to climate change? And so it turns out we can better understand this by breaking apart the problem. And the way that we can break apart this problem is to dissect it and say, well, how much of this response is due to the fact that land warms up when you increase carbon dioxide, versus, which would tend to, you know, make this low pressure even lower, versus what happens when we increase carbon dioxide and the ocean temperature warms up, which would try to produce low pressures over the ocean, okay, because warm air is consistent with low pressure. And it turns out if we can use the model to separate those two effects. And this is something that John and I have been working on this summer. And what we find, let's just focus on the schematic, that's probably the easiest to understand, and then we'll show the support with the actual model predictions on the right. So here's those two scenarios I just described. If you warm up land, which is what you do in the summertime, you produce more precipitation and in general low pressure over land. And you're feeding in the moisture from the ocean, which has cooler temperatures and higher pressures. This is called the sea breeze. But if you warm up the ocean, let's say, you know, in this model world, we can hypothetically warm up the ocean without warming up the land. That's how cool it is to be a modeler. Then we would expect the opposite, that, you know, the low pressures, the warmer temperatures will be over the ocean, which means the convection will be over the ocean, which means that the winds will change sign at the surface here, and the whole pattern will be reversed. So this is what normally happens between summer and winter, and now I've relabeled these between land warming and ocean warming. And that's exactly what we see when we break apart this problem in this model world. So we've taken a simulation where we've artificially controlled the sea surface and not allowed it to change in temperature. So it's fixed, it maintains its current value, but we've increased carbon dioxide. So this mostly warms over land. And then you can see all the red, which is increased precipitation, is falling over land. West Africa, South Asia, a little bit over North America, and also here in South America. And then when you do the opposite, complementary experiment, where you increase the sea surface temperatures, because we can artificially control them, but hold the carbon dioxide fixed, We have a weaker Asian monsoon, and most of the precipitation you can see in contrast is falling over the ocean. So when we add these two patterns up in terms of the wind that we were motivated at the beginning, so the low pressure that we have in the black contours here over Asia, what happens when we warm land, we have a stronger Asian monsoon, and when we warm the ocean, we have a weaker Asian monsoon. And so when we sum these two together, we have a large positive increase added to a large negative increase, and the net result is that very weak response that we found. Okay, so we would never have been able to understand what was going on without being able to break this type of response apart. And that's why the models are so important, because they allow us to do these controlled hypothesis testing experiments just as we could do in the lab if we were actually experimenting, if the climate could really be treated as an experimental science. So that's all I want to talk about today. I'll just summarize with a few key features of the talk that I hope you'll be able to take away. And of course, I'll be happy to answer any questions. So the first is that our understanding of global climate and global climate change is based on fundamental physics. I walked through a few examples. They were simple enough, I think, that, you know, at a high school level, if you're teaching earth science with some knowledge of mathematics, you could really, you know, convey this to your students. It's certainly something that we aim to do in our undergraduate class. And specifically, I'm talking about that standard model. It's really amazing to be able to tell someone that, you know, they can predict what the surface temperature of Mars is if you give them how much sunlight Mars receives, what the albedo of Mars is, a little bit about its surface, and so on. And this is exactly how scientists are trying to determine all these exoplanets, if these exoplanets will be habitable or not. And this is a very exciting time from the perspective of planetary science. But it's all, again, comes from physics. And climate models, while they have limitations, and many people, as we saw in that survey, don't really give them to be very trustworthy. They represent our physical understanding. And so if they're flawed, it's because we are flawed. But they are subject to some very important constraints. And therefore, we can a priori, you know, even without running a climate model, we should have some physical intuition as to how the atmosphere, the climate, will change if we increase carbon dioxide. And then if you trust weather models, which I understand, you know, many people do, but, you know, you should have the same level of confidence. These are the same beast with a slightly different resolution, I would call it. And then climate science, you know, model hierarchies, model simulations, computer science, which is another exciting field. This is what I think should be attractive to many people, that you can use the models as a laboratory analog to test hypotheses, and it's not unlike molecular biology. And it really is an exciting time in climate science. Our models are getting better and better, and we're, I think, really increasing our understanding significantly. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.